Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the July 30th edition of Radioactive Magazine. I'm your host, Pat Reilly, and my guests this evening are Mary Ladke and Jim Hanna from Peace Works, and Diane Burkholder, a local community organizer and equity consultant who is assisting this year's Unplaza Art Fair and help them reach new artists and community organizations. The Unplaza Art Fair, we'll talk about a little bit later, is one of the bigger fundraisers for Peaceworks Kansas City. So definitely something that you want to keep in mind as we get a little bit closer to that date. Folks, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For folks who are not familiar with Peaceworks Kansas City, in 1982, the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Committee of the KC Interfaith Peace Alliance was formed and became the KC Nuclear Weapons Freeze Coalition. In 1990, it became Peaceworks, Inc., and in 1996, Peaceworks Kansas City. Mary, could you tell us just a little bit about the mission of Peaceworks KC?
Sure. Peaceworks is a local community peace and justice organization, and my favorite quick description of Peaceworks is working for a world of peace without war and its weapons. Peaceworks is involved in many issues, not only war and nuclear weapons. Our work includes the struggle against racism, poverty, gun violence, and the climate crisis. But today we're here to talk specifically about three things: the resistance and arrests at the Kansas City Nuclear Parts Plant on Botts Road, which currently manufactures 85% of the parts needed for the U.S. nuclear arsenal, which is a very serious topic, and Jim Hannon will be discussing that, as well as the related Hiroshima-Nagasaki remembrance that's going to be held on August 4th. And then, on a much lighter, more fun note, we'll talk about the upcoming 29th Annual Unplaza Art Fair. And that's set for Saturday and Sunday, the 21st and 22nd of September, at Southmoreland Park. And most people know that's the place where they have the outdoor Shakespearean Festival by the museum. And then the Unplaza Art Fair offers quality, affordable, and unique art by local artists. Diane Burkholder is here to speak about the artist's application, and you still have time to apply, and the two artist workshops she has developed. Diane is also going to provide you with more details about the fair.
Super. Well, real quickly, I noticed that browsing on the Peaceworks KC website that there are several areas of focus, and you mentioned just a couple that we're going to talk about this evening. Now, Jim was here with us a couple of weeks ago, probably a couple of months ago, and he was one of the folks that was arrested at the new nuclear power plant. The old plant was on Bannister and then was rebuilt and moved down to Botts Road. So Jim was a former scofflaw. We use that term with a giggle. That's what I called him the last time we were in here.
I remember.
Jim, when is the court date?
August 7th will be the court date. There are 17 people who crossed the line in a peace witness or a protest on Memorial Day. It's the 10th year we've had a Memorial Day witness to try to draw attention to the hazards. It's really, to me, a clear and present danger of nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons production.
Mm-hmm. Mary, were you part of the arrested group?
No, I was a part of the die-in, and I was there, but I was not arrested.
And the die-in, that happens at the old facility, isn't it?
Or no, it's at the new facility.
At the new facility, too?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I know they all meet at the old plant on Bannister and then move out to the new one on Botts Road. So the die-in was at Botts Road, too?
Yes.
Okay, I wasn't clear on that one. Jim, understand that you said that it's been going on for 10 years. The protest has been going on for 10 years. How long has the weapons parts been manufactured in Kansas City at either of the two facilities? How long has this been going on here?
Well, collectively, 70 years. It's kind of hard to believe. I'm 71, so all of my lifetime. And the amazing part is that people if you just talk to people on the street, a lot of people aren't aware of that. They aren't aware that 85% of the components and parts, non-nuclear parts for nuclear weapons, our whole arsenal, all originate here in Kansas City and have been for 70 years.
Interesting. And I know that there have been a lot of health issues with the folks that have worked at those at the old plant that has come to light here over the last few years, too, that is a concern not only to the community but to the families of the workers that have been out there for all those years.
Yes, when we have our peace witness, we start at the old plant because that's kind of where it all started. And we had members and who worked there, employees, former employees who worked there, and family members. And there have been several hundred people who have been proven to have contacted diseases because there's a lot of heavy metals that are involved in the production of nuclear weapons. And especially early on, there wasn't a lot of awareness about that. Mm-hmm. The concern we have now is that those people be taken care of and their families. Also that the old plant itself is now being being raised. All the buildings are being removed and being asphalted over, and they're going to actually start using it again. We had a fellow who came from Sierra Club, and he described that facility as polluted into perpetuity, meaning there's absolutely no way on earth that you could make that really safe. And so really what's happening again is things are just being covered over, just like the fact that ever since we started into the whole nuclear arms race and so forth, the government's kind of been covering things over. But when Hiroshima happened and Nagasaki, there was an intentional effort to suppress that awareness. They didn't want people to see the pictures, the human pictures of what actually happened there. They confiscated all the films. They told the journalists that they couldn't report that and so forth. It wasn't until 7 years after the fact that Look magazine finally let the public actually see the human face of what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Before, it was all just buildings and destruction and stuff like that.
Given that long history, during which really no nuclear weapons have been detonated, why the concern and urgency today?
Well, for one thing, we're kind of trying, it looks to me like with the current administration, we're trying to make America nuclear again. There's an effort to modernize all these weapons. We're planning to spend $1 trillion in the next 30 years. This is budgeted dollars. When I became aware of all this and started coming down to the new plant and trying to say, hey, we don't really need any more of these weapons. We have more than enough of these weapons. I was trying to raise a question about, well, is it good for the grandkids? And I think that's a really good question. I think the answer is clearly no, but right now in our world there are more and more nations clamoring to become nuclear, join the nuclear club, like Saudi Arabia, for instance, and we seem to be going the wrong direction with it. We're having more and more proliferation. We have more and more vulnerability due to terrorists and terrorist groups, and deterrence is really not, that's old news. That's not really going to work.
Well, some information that we had gotten from Spencer Graves, who is also part of KC Peaceworks and here at KKFI, one of the things that he passed on to me when we first met here shortly after you all were arrested back in Memorial Day, when the nuclear non-proliferation, easy for me to say, non-proliferation treaty took effect in 1970, there were 5 nuclear weapon states. When President George W. Bush described an axis of evil, there were 8. Now there are 9, and we're on the verge of several more because of the United States backing out of the non-proliferation treaty.
Yeah, there's such a hypocrisy to it. It's like once you get in the club, then you try to keep everybody else out of the club, like it's an exclusive club. And somehow or another, these nations feel like that, well, they're the only people that can be entrusted with these weapons. And in my opinion, no nation can be trusted with these weapons. We don't know what's going to happen by accident or by design. I think they said it so well back in the day when they talked about MAD, mutually assured destruction. It's madness. It truly is. And somehow or another, we seem to want to double down on this madness rather than going the other direction, which we promised all those years ago to say, look, if all the other 190 nations of the world don't get nuclear weapons, we will reduce and eventually eliminate our nuclear weapons. That was the pledge we took. We are not doing that now, and neither are the other nations there.
So the deterrent argument is really bogus.
Well, I think so. I think anymore. Well, about 10 years ago, I saw an ad in the Wall Street Journal, and it was the what they call the four horsemen of the apocalypse. That was Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense, and his cohorts. They were the architects of the policy of deterrence. They came out with a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal, said, you know what? Deterrence is no longer valid. That was old news. This is a new world. Now we have terrorists and terrorist states. Any of them can acquire these things. They're not going to be deterred by global destruction or omnicide. I mean, that would, to them, for some of them, that would be like, wow, that's just fantastic. That's Allah or whoever, you know, God, whoever calls us to do that.
Going back to the get-together on Memorial Day where everybody was arrested, just to take a step back here real quick, 17 of you were arrested and charged with trespassing, I believe.
Right.
Okay. And court date was when again?
August 7.
Do you know how the folks are pleading? Are they going to go guilty, not guilty? We mentioned something about that when we were talking outside, that you're not quite sure what it will be because of the chance to make your voices known.
Well, it's kind of a dilemma, and I've struggled with it myself, because in a way, you're, simply put, you're guilty. I mean, there was a line painted on the asphalt, and we were cautioned. Once we stepped over the line, we were cautioned two or three times that we would be arrested if we didn't step back over the line. So, simply put, we were arrested in one sense. But in the larger sense, and this is what almost all of us are now going to plead not guilty, because we feel like the real guilt isn't for the people who are trying to protest or lift up a peace witness or something. The real crime against humanity is happening on the other side of the line, where people are continuing to develop these weapons and distribute them throughout the world, and the whole world really is being held hostage by nuclear weapons in a way you can't even imagine. With the Trident submarine, 14 of these submarines all over the world secretly, no one knows where they're at, off anybody's shore of any nation, and they have a capacity, an explosive capacity, which was so incredible. I can't even hardly imagine it. Those 14 nuclear armed subs have the equivalent, if they were to use all the nuclear weapons they have, of about 5,000 Hiroshimas. 5,000 Hiroshimas. And they're all patrolling, you know, not all at the same time, but the force as a whole has that capacity. It's madness.
Well, another note that we had gotten from Spencer, from our previous program, is said that climatologists have said that if less than 2% of the U.S. nuclear arsenal were used, it could produce a nuclear autumn and drought, leading to the deaths from starvation of perhaps a billion people, not counting those who were directly involved in the nuclear exchange. With the population of the United States of approximately 352 million now, times three,
right,
easily.
Yeah, it's staggering. I think that's why maybe people don't like to think about it or talk about it, because it's just almost impossible to get your mind around the magnitude of devastation and destruction. It omnicide. It's a word that hardly anybody uses or hardly anybody's even heard of before, but that omni means all. It means the destruction of all life as we know it on our planet. That is truly the capacity we have now. And it wouldn't take that many of these weapons. I've seen projections saying if 100 of the roughly 12,000 nuclear weapons that are still on Earth, down from 70,000, thank goodness, but still 12,000 of them. But even if 100 of them were used, like in a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, for instance, you know, that would basically bring about a nuclear winter that would, you know, kill
eliminate millions. Life.
Yeah,
eliminate
right.
life on this planet.
Right.
One of the things that has been of concern to me was, we spoke about just a few minutes ago, is the United States leaving the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. I have to say that's slow so I can get the whole word in. We were probably, being the U.S., was probably the biggest, made the biggest push for that in the 60s. because of the supposed Red Scare that we had in the 50s. And you know, me growing up, and I think you were real close to the same age.
Do you remember Duck and Cover?
That's exactly what I was going to say, Duck and Cover in grade school. And, you know, you'd be sitting in the hallway with your head between your legs and holding on for dear life and hoping. And it seems to be what we have now could easily be that kind of scenario again.
Yeah, and even worse, because yes, we have fewer weapons, but they have more. They have greater capacity. And so it's truly a frightening time. I mean, the bulletin of atomic scientists, they're the ones that kind of keep track of how the Earth might end. If they have set their clock to 2 minutes to midnight, kind of symbolically saying that's how close we are, and they've moved it up since in the last 2 years because of the way new nations are trying to come on board, the way we're doing this, all the saber rattling, the nuclear nations now, like you say, the non-proliferation is kind of being scuttled, and it will end next year unless something happens.
Mm-hmm. An interesting thing that I read is the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge estimated a 0.6% chance of a nuclear war in the next year. And we get to that 2 minutes before midnight scenario that you were talking about. Standard statistical theory said that's equivalent to a 21% chance of a nuclear war in the next 40 years and almost a 40% chance of a nuclear war in the next 80 years within the normal anticipated lifetimes of most of the great-grandchildren of people alive today.
Well, I think that's optimistic myself. I think my time frame would be shorter because I think it's really only just by good luck and who knows what, that we haven't had more major incidents to this point. I don't think people realize how close we came during the Cuban Missile Crisis to really to that point. And I certainly don't think people understand today, by and large, how close we are to, again, by either by accident or by design or just by someone just losing it. We're just... JFK talked about, as the president, he talked about the sword of Damocles, you know, which just hangs by a single slender thread. And he was talking about that back in the 60s. And, you know, it seems to me that that thread is becoming more and more stretched thinner and thinner. And all this bellicose language we have between nations who are vying for or already have nuclear weapons, it's very frightening.
Well, I'll say we're rattling right now.
Oh, boy.
Let's kick down to the topic of the remembrance here that's coming up on Sunday, August the 4th. It's the Hiroshima, or did I pronounce it? Is it Hiroshima or Hiroshima? I've heard it pronounced either way.
Both ways.
The Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance, which is on Sunday, August the 4th. I understand you guys have two big annual observances, the Memorial Day Peace Witness and this Remembrance this Sunday. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening on Sunday?
Yes, yeah, so we come together at 6:30 for a potluck dinner. People should bring their potluck, and it's in a park, Luce Park. And then at 7:30 is a program. Usually there's a Bakasha or a survivor that speaks. We gong the bell. However many years it's been since mm-hmm. there's been, you know, the attack on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We have peace cranes usually hanging from the trees. It's very beautiful and a tranquil setting. It's kind of it's both to lament what happened and to also look forward with hope that we not do it again, because all the Waukesha, the survivors, their major message is one way or another, never again. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to say, never again. We must never, never do this again.
Does somebody come over from Japan, from either of those two cities, to participate in this? Do you have anything like in a sister city type operation with either of the entities?
No, we don't. For the last several years, there has been a grandson of one of the actual survivors who has come and shared with us.
Several years ago, or several decades ago, actually, a book was written that was titled Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. We're now more than 70 years since the atomic bombs were dropped over the two cities. Do you think that as a nation we are still in denial about those attacks, or is it something that we've since it's so long, I mean, I can remember it because it was part of the history that I learned about when I was growing up. I mean, you know, I'm in my 60s, you're in your 70s, and it was part of what was taught to us in schools. And it was also something that was closer to us because the order came from Harry Truman, who was president at the time. And, you know, Harry is a Kansas City and a Missouri boy. So right. It was part of the history we learned of Missouri and Harry. Are we in denial about that? Do we push it to the back of our minds because it's not out there in the forefront like it was for many, many years?
Well, I think during the 1980s, there was quite a revival of people, like you mentioned, the Red Scare and so forth. And then when basically the Soviet bloc collapsed, then people kind of forgot about it. And they thought, oh, well, I took care of that problem. And basically, we just have moved ahead as if it didn't even exist. So, yes, I think we are in denial. But I think it's also been an intentional thing. I do think that the government has basically tried to say, this is not a problem. Don't worry about it. Don't look here. I remember going out to Rocky Flats in Colorado, just downwind and downstream from Denver, for Pete's sake. And during the 80s, there were so many people who were trying to be peace witnesses. They actually surrounded that plant and for some time obstructed the ongoing production there. And it's unthinkable, you know, what would have happened. And they did have a near meltdown to the point that the roof got hot and started to sag and so forth. I mean, it could have wiped out Denver very easily. If you read a book called Full Body Burden about someone who, you know, went through that and lived there, they told people that they were just building refrigerators or something like that at Rocky Flats, you know, and they're making all these plutonium pits and everything like that. You know, it's incredible. And they've not been fully forthcoming about people that live close to the plants, like in Nevada. What about the 500 atmospheric tests that we've had and so forth? I think that those things have never gone away, that they're still. We say we haven't used nuclear weapons. Well, I think they're being used all the time to intimidate other nations and make them do what we want them to do. And also, they're being used by virtue of the fact that we have all these pollutants, which we're like a big lab experiment to see, well, what's the long-range effect of that going to be? Cancer, anyone? You know, I mean, it's remarkable.
And on Sunday, this is open to the general public. Anybody that would like to come?
Absolutely. We'd love to have people come. It's so important to remember, because if we don't remember, then we're just doomed to repeat the thing all over again. So we don't want to do that. So it's Sunday, August 4th. 6:30 is the potluck. 7:30 is the program. It's at Kansas City's Luce Park, which is at Warnall and 53rd Street. Mm-hmm. We'd sure love to have everybody come.
Okay. Is it, just out of curiosity, is it in the area near the Rose Garden, or is it on the, do you know where the area it's going to be held at?
Well, I think it's fairly close there. It's at the lagoon.
Yeah. Okay.
It's,
yeah. Okay.
Just so beautiful setting.
In case folks would like to come out and make it a little easier to find, because Luce Park does have a little bit of size to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to switch gears now here real quick, and we're going to talk to Diane Burkholder. And I introduced her earlier as the local community organizer and equity consultant who's assisting this year's Unplaza Art Fair, which is one of the big fundraisers for Peaceworks Kansas City. Hi, Diane.
Hello. Thanks
How
for
are you
having
doing?
Me. I'm good.
Well, good. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Yeah. So I am helping out this year with the Unplaza Art Fair. I've been familiar with the fair as long as I've lived here in Kansas City, since 2011. And I was excited to find something that was, you know, a little different than the Plaza Fair. It was featuring local folks. And I was going to the fair, and I was like, this is great and amazing, but I don't see a lot of folks that look like me. And I started having conversations with board members throughout the years. And about 6 months ago, I had a conversation with a board member, and she was like, you have some really great ideas. We want to try some things out. Why don't you come on board? So I put together a proposal, and here I am actually making the work, making it happen when I, you know, have tried to envision some years ago. And so this is the biggest fundraiser for Peaceworks. Last year was the biggest fundraiser of all time. It's the 29th annual. Last year we raised $19,000. And I really appreciate the fair because it is really centered on local artists. It's, like Mary said, it's going to take place September 21st and 22nd from 10 to 6 on Saturday and from 10 to 5 on Sunday. And one of the things I'm really working on doing on making this fair, it's always had a really good turnout, over 100 artists, is to make it as accessible to folks, to new artists, to young artists of color, to folks that are maybe not used to the fair scene. I organize with creatives, and my mom's a creative, but I'm not a creative myself. But getting into the fair scene is a lot. Where they take place, what is the application process, how do you set up a booth? So we're working on things to make it easier for people to really go out and, you know, show their wares, and for the community to support the organizations. And so a couple things we're doing. This year is the first year we've had a move from a paper application to an online application. So we have a Google form. People can put in their information, pay via PayPal or pay via check if they still would choose to send in a check. And we're taking applications through August 15th. And one thing we're doing this year is we're working with two local artists, Vanya Soto and Clarissa Knighton. We're offering two workshops for artists, whether they're seasoned artists or whether they're brand new. Mm-hmm. I had a friend that did the fair about 4 years ago, and she's an amazing artist, but she didn't know how to set up a booth. She'd never done it before. And it can become very intimidating of, how do I even do this? And so the first one we're going to offer is August 17th. Vanya, who's been a Kansas City artist, been an artist for 13 years, is doing a workshop called Artist as Brand. How do you market yourself, not only beyond your art, but beyond your art as an artist, into the community? And then on the 27th, Clarissa Knighton, who runs Rissa's Designs, does these really great, amazing, elaborate, really works of arts necklaces. She's doing a workshop on how to get a second look, how to capture the right customer, how to set up a booth. And so we're providing those two workshops for Unplaza artists that submit their application in time. So, like, can I say the amount?
No.
I cannot say the amount. I didn't think so. It is a very low fee, I will say, just looking at it. I didn't think I could, so I won't. But compared to other fairs, it is really accessible, and the artists get to keep a large portion of their proceeds. Many fairs take very high percentages, and this is accessible. We'll have food trucks. We'll have a family area. We're going to have also community organizations. So if folks are interested as community organizations to do outreach, they can do so by accessing the information either at PeaceWorksKC/Unplaza or on the Facebook page. There's a Facebook event. And we also have opportunities for volunteers. So if folks want to cashier or help out with traffic, there's also a link for folks to sign up to volunteer as well.
Well, about a minute and a half left. I got a quick question for you today. How, when you talk about reaching out to artists and get them involved, mm-hmm. do you go to places like, let's say, KC Art Institute and catch some of the upcoming artists there that are, you mm-hmm. know, learning the trades and then relying on other folks that you know to local artists to spread out the work?
Yeah, they're actually, there's kind of a mix of folks that have come out of KCAI, but a big part of it is just getting to know artists in the community. Since I'm fortunate of working with a few artist organizations, I've gotten to know a lot of artists that have not ever done a fair before. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a lot of word of mouth. We're doing email blasts. We have now an Instagram and a Twitter if people aren't really on Facebook mm-hmm. or online. I'm really just trying to get people to get in the door. And once we know people get in, it's all word of mouth and people are going to spread. So I'm excited that this year will be bigger and better.
How many exhibitors are you anticipating?
Anticipating. As of last Thursday, we had 88 signed up.
Nice.
And the deadline is still a couple weeks, so I'm anticipating we'll probably have at least 125 people.
And the date on that again, folks?
September 21st and 22nd.
Super, super. Well, we're just about ready to wrap it up here. We have had the folks from Peaceworks KC with us this evening. Mary Ladke, Jim Hanna, and Diane Burkholder. Thank you very much. I appreciate you all coming in and sharing the time and the energy with us. And folks, keep this good organization in mind, and also the Unplaza Art Fair coming in September, and more importantly, the Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance this Sunday at Luce Park. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Pat, and to your guest. The next week we will have on David Mitchell. He will be interviewing Frank Jacob, who is the technology manager for Black & Veatch, and they will be talking about the transitioning to renewable energy and some of the problems associated with that. After Then next coming up, Bill Claus is going to do the calendar. And then we will have a few messages followed by Counterspin. And then at 7, Viviana with the Taste of Tiana.
Okay, on Wednesday, July 31st, 6 p.m., that's tomorrow, of course, Feeding the Homeless at the Rhyme Buddhist Center, 700 West Pinway, Casey Moe. You help fill Bodie bags with food for the homeless. Thursday, August the 1st, the Green Party KC membership meeting at the Westport Presbyterian Church, 201 Westport Road. Sunday, August 4th, Overland Park People's Assembly on Medicare for All at the Central Resource Library, Johnson County Library, 9875 West 87th, Overland Park, Kansas. I want to again thank Pat Reilly and the guests from All Souls, and thank our engineer today, Craig Lubo.
On the next Sprouts, part one of a die-in and civil disobedience at the Kansas City Weapons Plant.
Willie Dexter Watkins, who worked at the Kansas City plant, was diagnosed with heart failure at age 32.
And remember, people, these people took a physical before they came here, so he was suffering from any heart problems before he came here.
Thursday at noon.
Hey, Kansas City. What's your point of view? If you've got something important to say, let us know. KKFI recently launched a new community podcast page on our website at kkfi.org. It already hosts an amazing selection of KKFI's on-air programming as podcasts, and we're not done. We want to give a platform to all the voices in Kansas City and our immediate region. Do you have a podcast, or have you always wanted to try but don't know how? Go to kkfi.org, select Community Podcast, and click Apply to share your ideas and sign up for classes to learn how. That's kkfi.org/community-podcasts, and we hope to hear from you real soon.
I say hey there, Mr.
Peaceworks KC is hosting its annual Hiroshima-Nagasaki Remembrance at the south end of the lagoon at Luce Park, August 4th, with a potluck at 6:30 and program at 7:30. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, someone was asleep in the tone deafness department at the New York Times and allowed the paper to describe Puerto Rico as a place where, quote, people enjoy the benefits of American citizenship but cling to their own Spanish-speaking culture, close quote. Besides whatever the paper means by clinging to a culture, it's weird to say Puerto Ricans do so despite benefits of U.S. citizenship they rather famously do not enjoy, like real representation in Congress. That tossed-off sentence is one hint that elite outlets are not the first place to look for a serious understanding of fast-moving but deeply rooted events in Puerto Rico right now, where massive popular protests have just led to the resignation of Governor Ricardo Rosselló. We'll talk about Puerto Rico with Ed Morales. He teaches at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He co-directed the documentary Whose Barrio, and he's author of the forthcoming Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. With the presidential election over a year away, corporate media seem to be offering a preview of the sort of thing we have to look forward to. One is the time-worn tradition of going to rural white communities to take the pulse of the nation. Fair election analyst Julie Holler pointed to a July 22nd New York Times story under the web headline, "These Michigan Voters Show How Trump's Go Back Attack May Help Him," in which reporters ventured to a Trump stronghold in Michigan to bring readers the front page news that people who supported Trump in 2016 in the face of his racist attacks still support him in the face of his racist attacks. The Times' Stephanie Saul and Jeremy Peters described their look into St. Clair County, quote, "In this overwhelmingly white district, an hour north of Detroit, where his popularity remains high, his comments left people in the familiar position of having to choose a side in the aftermath of another Trump-instigated outrage. And they chose his," close quote. The article went on to talk a great deal about the importance of Michigan to the presidential election as a swing state, about counties that had swung from Obama to Trump, and about how close polls are in those counties right now. All that would imply that St. Clair County is one of those where people were more ambivalent about Trump, and therefore it's informative about which way Michigan might go this time around. But no, St. Clair County went for Romney by 7 points in 2012 and for Trump by 31 points. Disguising that fact, Holler notes, in a story in which the people all seem to be of a Trumpian persuasion, makes it hard to escape the conclusion that the point of these person-in-the-street interviews was to give Trump supporters a platform, rather than to take a real look at what Michigan voters think. One thing such stories do achieve, an echo chamber for right-wing talking points. In this case, the Time interviews a local Republican strategist who comments that the Democratic congresswomen under attack, quote, "very much represent the loony left," close quote. This quote was then selected by a Times editor to feature in the print edition subhead, "Michigan Voters Who Worry More About the Loony Left," thus twisting a Republican catchphrase into voter worries. It's a common theme of Trump coverage that's now extending to election coverage. When people protest something Donald Trump does or says, corporate media feel the need to also talk about the people who aren't reacting as a sort of faux balance, giving us Trump supporters support Trump stories. At times, the orchestration required becomes apparent, as when CNN on July 16th and 17th presented a panel of what viewers were told were 8 Republican women from Dallas who don't see anything wrong with President Trump telling 4 Democratic congresswomen to go back where they came from. Well, sharp-eyed viewers quickly pointed out that these apparently randomly selected Republican women offering insights like that Trump's comments couldn't be racist because he, quote, "didn't say a color," close quote, were actually dedicated Trump activists, members of a group called Trumpets for America, and they'd appeared multiple times on CNN in the past, likewise identified only as Republican women. CNN's response to the criticism? It ran the segment again, for the 5th time, this time with a brief nod to the women's affiliations. Meanwhile, the underlying premise of the segment, that viewers need to hear again and again that Republicans who have supported Trump through his racist xenophobic campaign and his racist xenophobic administration continue to support him after his latest racist xenophobic tirade, remains unquestioned. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. That's critical to understanding the island's historical, political, and economic situation. And we rightfully make fun of, especially politicians, who seem not to understand that. On another level, there are reasons to think about Puerto Rico as a different place. Puerto Ricans' decisive, collective uprising in response to clear revelations of anti-humane governance, not the least of them. It's hard not to find inspiration in the vibrant, multi-sector protests in Puerto Rico and on the mainland, even recognizing the deep hardships and systemic failures that fuel them. We're recording on July 25th. Governor Ricardo Rosselló announced his resignation late last night. Joining us now to talk about the protests that made that happen and what in turn spurred them is writer Ed Morales. He teaches at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race, and his new book, Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico, is forthcoming from Bold Type Press. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ed Morales.
Hi. How are you doing, Janine?
I'm good. Well, to begin and end with these private text conversations recently exposed among Rosselló and these 11 advisors would be to miss the point. But those chats were a flashpoint for a reason, because of what they revealed and also what they illustrated, the attitude of these men, they were all men, toward women, gay people, opponents, supporters. It's a cornucopia of toxicity. Can you place, though, the latest revelations in the context of what we and what Puerto Ricans already knew?
Sure. The chats really have gotten a lot of attention because of the offensive content. And that's really important to underline, and it is part, a really big part of the response against him. It's really important to also understand that in the chats were potential outlinings of a case against the governor and the other people in the chat, most of whom he dismissed or accepted their resignations, that had to do with the improper sharing of information with particularly one man named Elias Sanchez, who is this sort of super lobbyist and consultant in Puerto Rico, who was in on all these conversations about official government business. And a lot of the vulgar attacks that they directed at people had to do with these seedy kind of contract deals that people like Elias Sanchez and Edwin Miranda, who was one of the major public relations people in Puerto Rico, profited from. So I think the main reason that I really think a lot of people got upset was the Christian Sorbino comment. Christian Sorbino was the governor's non-voting representative on the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board and also in charge of this financial institution that had replaced the Government Development Bank, which was dissolved during the debt crisis. So that's the one that Christian Sorbino joked about, the fact that bodies that were from the Hurricane Maria, you know, and whether there were any crows or vultures available to eat them to relieve the stress of the piling of the body. People who were really suffering emotionally from the after effects of Hurricane Maria and probably even economically were most upset about that. Then there are all the people who were upset about the anti-women and homophobic content. But I think that people in Puerto Rico were really well aware of the corruption rumors. You know, 2 weeks before, the Secretary of Education was arrested along with the Secretary of Health Insurance for improper granting of contracts without proper bidding procedures. And also, Puerto Rico has suffered through several corruption scandals from both of its major political parties for 20 years at least.
So it's not just being nasty, although there's a long list of that if folks want to look for that.
It's everything all together.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Rosselló would said he was letting off steam, but then this real favor trading. Well, in your piece for The Nation, you note that the blame for the pervasive nature of corruption in the government can clearly be laid on these politicians themselves, their privileged boys club and their private school elitism. But you say Puerto Rico's colonial relationship with the United States must also be blamed. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, I think there's two things that we can talk about there. One is, as I stated in the piece, because Puerto Rico does not have a voting representative in Congress, that's part of the deal of being an unincorporated territory and yet having citizenship. They have this thing called the resident commissioner. It's an office. And really, the resident commissioner really lives the life, basically, of a U.S. representative, except they don't have a vote. So their main way to influence what goes on in Washington is to lobby informally their fellow legislators, and they're really involved in the Puerto Rico government lobbying process, which is carried out by this agency called PRAFA, which has offices in Washington and New York. So that sort of culture of the only political power that you have is lobbying, I think, in a way, sort of seeps back to the island, and particularly when you see that many of the recent governors were resident commissioners before they came governor, because it's sort of a platform. It's sort of like being a governor or a senator is a platform for being elected president. Being the resident commissioner is so. So it's sort of a culture of lobbying and cultivating influence and influence peddling that happens. And because of the imposition of the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board, it's taken away so much of the agency of the government itself on the island, because all of its moves have to be approved by the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board. I mean, in terms of apportionment, and that's what most of the legislation has to do with. Democracy has become kind of a joke on the island, because there's a delegitimization that happens with the oversight board.
Yeah, and the institutional roots and the connection to the mainland, structural roots of the problems, that is why I so much dislike a media line or a kind of sub-narrative I'm seeing. The New York Times podcast returned to it repeatedly. So weeks after President Trump calls the government of Puerto Rico corrupt, there are all these indictments that basically say he's right. You know, there's this line that, you know, Trump was correct, as if his Gatling gun of insults actually hitting something were, like, super meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the guy who threw paper towels at people. You know, let's give him another listen about what's best for those people. I find that very frustrating in terms of media coverage, this lack of awareness of what you're just talking about, the fact that, you know, the political class in a colonized place is going to be part of the problem, and that's not an argument for more colonization.
Well, I haven't gone to the bottom of it, but all of the corruption and investigations that led up to this, save for the last move by the Puerto Rico's Department of Justice, has been handled by the U.S. Department of Justice. It's not fair to say that the U.S. Department of Justice is carrying out completely Trump's agenda, but you do have an increasingly assertive Bob Barr. There was a problem with the previous police monitor that Puerto Rico's police are still under consent decree, and the previous monitor was harassed out of office. That's part of the chats as well. That may have been something that came from Barr's leadership of the Attorney General. Even going back to Sessions, when Sessions was Attorney General, he wanted to relax some of these cities that were under consent decrees, saying that it was, you know, inhibiting law enforcement by having these police departments under consent decree, which means they're monitored by what's called a police monitor. So there are two other investigations, one in California and one, I'm told, from the Southern District of New York, which, as you know, has been active in monitoring Trump, that have to do with deals with the electrical authority and the health insurance area, respectively, that I'm not sure if that is something that's coming from Bob Barr or from the Trump agenda. But definitely the involvement of the FBI and the Department of Justice in this is really something I think that raises eyebrows. And I will tell you one more story about that. The initial revelations about corruption in the Rosselló government started to happen around the Secretary of Finance, Raul Maldonado, who resigned and then gave an interview to the major newspaper in Puerto Rico saying that there was institutional corruption in the government.
He called it a mafia, right?
Institutional mafia, right. Then his son gave an interview to the same newspaper and said he had some information about the Rosselló government that they would see that this would come out. So then 2 weeks later, this chat comes out. Now, of course, you know, the Center for the Investigative Journalism cannot reveal the source of the chat. I'm just speculating. We have no idea what the source of the chat leak is. But you have to be interested in the fact that Raul Maldonado and his son both have access to the chat, and it suddenly appeared 2 weeks later after his son said that something big was going to come. And so that was after they were cooperating with the FBI.
And didn't something happen to his son then after that? Did his son then come under investigation himself? Or I feel like something further happened with the son. Maybe I'm confusing that.
Well, I don't actually remember what happened with the son, but I know that Raul Maldonado Sr. is still refusing to turn over his phone after several government officials were ordered to do so by the Puerto Rico Department of Justice last week.
Well, let's talk about the protests. The protests have been historic. More than 500,000 people in the street in San Juan for a national strike on July 22nd. More than 500,000 people on an island whose population is just over 3 million. A protest here in New York in Union Square was one of the most energetic seen in a long time. Even in U.S. media, most accounts are acknowledging that these protests were always about more than the chats, and even more than getting rid of Rosselló. Isn't that so?
Yes. Certainly there are a lot of pieces that are pointing to this sort of cultural nationalist revival in Puerto Rico. I do think that there's a new kind of nationalism that has taken off, which I think successfully combines identity politics, as in the personal is political, with awareness of class conflict. I think most people are really clear that the Rosselló-entitled governorship represents an elite class that has ties with the business elite and that they're on the other side of that struggle. I don't know how much the mainstream media is seeing it that way, but they are noting particularly the cultural expressions. There's been a lot of attention being paid to the musicians that showed up. There's even some mentions about the perreo combativo, which is this dance that is done to reggaeton music that is kind of overtly sexual that people were performing last night as a political act. So there's a lot of that, but I'm still disappointed that the mainstream media still seems to be focused on the idea that this is all caused by a corrupt government in Puerto Rico with no kind of visible narrative of the colonial control behind it. The Wall Street Journal had a really, and the Washington Post had these editorials that called for a strengthening of power for the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board.
As the response.
Yeah, right. The problem is Puerto Rico's endemic corruption, and so even more U.S. control and austerity is the remedy.
Yeah, I saw a line, and, you know, it's in what they say and how they say it, the kind of passive voice, this lazy coverage, like The Guardian, that talked about the island continues to reel from the effects of the devastating hurricane amid a faltering recovery effort led by the Trump administration. You know, and you think, well, wait, what?
Right.
You know, who are the political actors here? Or then the New York Times says, in this passive way, Puerto Ricans have, quote, suffered through unemployment, hurricanes, economic restructuring, and government-imposed austerity measures, close quote. You know, I mean, government-imposed, I guess, is the closest we get to having an actual actor, but it's not even clear what government they're talking about that's imposing
right.
the austerity. So you're right, there's no story being told. It's as if it's just kind of an endemic problem among Puerto Ricans.
Right. So, yeah, in the Washington Post, it was a comparison to the Washington Fiscal Oversight Board, which people still had a lot of problems with, but was more attentive to the concerns of D.C. Residents than this board, which is completely composed of the business community and, you know, in fact, has two members that have questionable conflict of interest with their ties to banks that helped to create the debt crisis in the first place.
On the one hand, I'm seeing media sometimes just quoting people saying that Puerto Rico is in kind of uncharted territory, and the level of the upheaval and the change that's being sought, but then at the same time I see elite media trying, or at least looking ready to circumscribe it. The New York Times said that many Puerto Ricans want out of the deal in which, quote, a fiscal control board designated by Congress has been calling many of the shots in recent years, forcing the island through strict austerity measures to manage a crippling debt crisis that caused it to declare a form of bankruptcy 2 years ago, close quote. But the Times then goes on to say, the people and their placards are unlikely to change that. They just state that, you know, saying it, they could change the political leadership in Puerto Rico, but they're not going to change this relationship with the fiscal control board. I don't know how the New York Times knows that when I doubt they knew 2 weeks ago that Rosselló was going to come down.
Yeah, I think there was very little awareness of the burgeoning corruption scandal in the mainstream media until the chats came out. Look, it's a formidable task that activism has to confront the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board because it is controlled by Congress and it has all that power. But certain things have happened. There are three things that I can point to that show that the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board is not an insurmountable foe. And the one is that there's two Supreme Court cases that are going to be heard in the fall, I think in October, that challenged the validity of the current members because it may have violated the appointments clause of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Judge Taylor Swain of the Title III Bankruptcy Court that is part of PROMESA has suspended all restructuring for 3 months until the government thing gets straightened out. It may be something that might not have a strong effect on unless there's even more of a Democratic majority or a Democratic president in 2020, but Raul Grijalva, who is the chairman of the National Resources Committee that's really in charge of what's going on in Puerto Rico, had been trying to put some reins on the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board, sort of redefine what its role was. He's been kind of vocal about that, and he was the first to call for Rosselló's resignation. So, you know, there is kind of a move among Democrats in Congress to try to limit some of the powers of the Fiscal Oversight Management Board. This really puts a dent in it, though. I mean, that is really one of the bad things about this. And again, that seems to really serve the interests of the Oversight Board and probably the Trump Republicans who are all involved in the disaster capitalism.
Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism, which we keep referring to, they were the catalyst for this and releasing the chats. And we know that that was very meaningful, you know, the tone of them was evidence in itself of a problem. And it was sufficient evidence to kind of tip something into something bigger. So I guess finally I would just say it is on one level a big win for journalism in the public interest, among the other things that it is, right?
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of awareness about Center for Investigative Journalists. The people involved are really accessible members of the community. They're not on this elite level like, say, you know, the mainstream media is in the U.S. They almost have an activist spirit about them. And I think most people realize and thank them for divulging all of this. And not only doing that, but just doing their commentary on it because it's really a long read. And, you know, the most important thing they did was vet a lot of it, make sure that it was not a false leak.
Right.
And then really put a lot of things into context, you know, with some of the pieces they wrote. They actually wrote a follow-up piece which in detail describes a lot of these potential violations. The committee that was set up to investigate the possible violations, which put out its report yesterday, concurs with a lot of the findings that are in the Center for Investigative Journalism report in terms of the potential violations, three of the criminal code and two of the ethics code that the Rosselló administration did. So they did a really strong follow-up and did not just leave it at the vulgar language.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Ed Morales. The new book, Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico, is out soon from Bold Type Press. You can still find his article, Why 500,000 Puerto Ricans Are Protesting in the Streets, online at thenation.com. Ed Morales, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thanks, as always.
And that
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter Extra or our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.